So first of all, thanks for having me here. I think Ningaloo was pretty formative in my career of trying to get on top of some of these questions. So I'd like to maybe give you a bigger, broader worldview of where we need to go on this kind of stuff. So the old view of the oceans was largely about fisheries and the footprint that it had, but that's not actually the new reality. So these are real pictures, primarily from Southeast Asia. And in many places in China, you now can't tell where the land ends and the ocean begins. It's not exactly the same up on Ningaloo. There's still a lot of sparse areas, but human pressure on that system and the expanding blue economy is as much an issue up there and needs the same kind of partnership approach as you'd get anywhere else in the world. So if we think about the history of the use of the planet, for a long time it's been on land and we've largely modified the land surface. The oceans are a bit different. It's taken us a bit longer, but if you can imagine everything that we do on land, we now do that in the sea. So if we have the agrarian revolution, the Industrial Revolution and the great acceleration of the 1950s that happened just after World War II on land, that's all happening in the oceans right now. So there's an exponential increase and it's only going to grow with the expansion of the blue economy. So the blue economy already brings in $55 to $75 billion in Australia per year. That's expected to rise to $100 billion by 2025 to 2050. On the global scale, it's about $450 billion a year at the present moment, but it's been assessed at having assets up to $24 trillion that could be accessed over the next 100 years pretty easily, which puts it at about the seventh largest economy on the planet. And largely, it's kind of flown under the radar. Through time, the management and the understanding of the resource has shifted from single species fish assessments to how those species sit in an ecosystem to actually trying to manage that ecosystem, but in places like Europe and America, they've already had to embrace the fact that it is all of those sectors at once. And how do you plan across all of those multiple uses and the people that live there and work there? So in places like Belgium, for instance, they've taken a classical, humans are two-dimensional land animals. They think of the world as flat and easily partitioned, and that's the role that they've taken in Belgium. They've tried to chunk everything up and put it in its own little box, kind of forgetting that the oceans don't make that world very functional, that smears things around with advection. Fish haven't been told about the lines in the sand, for instance, and naughtily swim across to somewhere they weren't expected to be. There's also the accumulation and interacting pressures that come when you have more than one use in one place. So the kinds of problems that face the world, these kind of problems sit in what's called a wicked problem. So humans are very good at simple problems, that there's a clear problem, there's a linear solution. Evolution set us up to go, there's something going to eat me over there, I need to get over there. We can modify that kind of thinking, that neurology and psychology, to deal with complex problems. Where there is a solution, it can take a bit of fart-arsing around and looking at this and looking at that and bringing things together to get to the outcome in a non-linear situation. But in complex situations, you can still find a solution. In wicked problems, there's so many feedbacks and changes through time that there is no one solution. So as soon as you do one thing in one spot, something else crops up somewhere else that then changes where you've got to go. So it's like steering, I don't know, I didn't watch a lot of the Winter Olympics recently, but the small part I did see, A, I'm glad I'm not a skier, but B, it looked quite complicated to get yourself everywhere you need to be at the same time, particularly with someone skiing what felt too close beside you. And that's probably what it's like to navigate through the expanding blue economy of all those interactions. Unfortunately, the human brain is very good at aiming at a target. It's much less good at juggling. And I could probably bring up a couple of oranges and show you how bad I am at juggling. But I think you get the idea of how complex it is to pull all that together. So why we like to think of ourselves as being this considered species. So for instance, I spent a lot of my life trying to pull things together to find some of those solutions in different places around the world. What it usually looks like is more like that. So how do we try and avoid that solution or that problem at any scale from Ningaloo all the way up? So historically, we've tended to parcel things up. So these happen to be different academics or different kinds of knowledge areas. Equally, it could be different government departments. They tend to sit separately and they don't tend to talk or interact. But for anyone who makes ropes and sails, you'll know that the combined rope is actually much, much stronger than those individual bits separate. So that's what we need to do. We need to have the partnerships to bring those different kinds of knowledge and thinking together to ultimately reach where we need to be. And part of that builds on the fact that our basic neurology and our psychology, if you look into the brains of a human trying to solve a problem, they really do reflect that if you only have a hammer, then you see every problem as a nail. We're very myopic in the way that we access different parts of the brain for particular questions. So, for instance, if you're a physicist and you're asked an oceans question, you'll focus on the physical dimensions of the system, and the human parts, the ecological parts, will sit to the side as what they call an externality, a little term on the end. Equally, if you're a marine ecologist, you'll focus on the marine, the living parts of the system, and the human bits will be the externality. When you get to economics and psychology and sociology, the focus on the human bits, and now it's the living and the physical world that's become the little bit on the end. So we get very focused on looking for the solution in the box that we understand. Unfortunately, that myopic view can often hide a really important part of what you're actually after. So there's a new expanding set of approaches to try and do this. This has grown over the last 20 to 30 years, but it's also in its exponential phase now. It's really kicked off. And that's trying to bring all of those different disciplines and the different knowledge types. So the knowledge is caught up in businesses like BHP and the individual engineers and clerks and all of the people that make up those businesses, as well as the people that live in the areas where all of these activities are happening. You bring all of that information together to get a much more round view of what's happening. You still need the excellence of the individual disciplines to dig into the details and understand that. There's no way you can get beyond that, but you need the linkages as well. And that's a lesson I learnt particularly hard and particularly in my face when I worked up on Ningaloo, that what we faced was a fundamental problem of actually how to do that knowledge exchange, how to build those partnerships in a lasting way. We were really communicating in a two-way street between them. And the problem is that we speak different languages, both between academic disciplines and between science and the broader community. So as an example, when we were up there for the cluster work, and I think this is a lesson that's been well learnt in for the Outlook, was we were asked to write one-page descriptions of each of the different bits of science so that we could share that information with people actually living in the region. Now, the scientists were asked to make it as in simple language as possible, and they delivered me the stuff in the orange. What they really meant was the stuff on the far side. So we get taught for 10 years how to speak special science language to make ourselves feel good to each other. What we need to do is get back to communicating with each other, because whether you're talking to someone on the street or you're actually just talking to a scientist or an academic in different discipline, you need that general language to actually communicate well. And that's really important because we're faced with a huge challenge in Australia in particular. So if we compare the size of Australia to the size of Europe, it's on roughly the same order of magnitude. There's about a 50% difference in the ocean area that we have to look at. So in Australia, we have a single marine vessel for the whole nation. We do have some other boats, obviously, in states that help to supplement that. But in reality, it's very few. In the same area in Europe, they have about 200, ignoring Finland and Russia. You add those in, it's 300. And so they have just a capacity that we will never have in Australia to cover that land area. In the US, for instance, they sample, I think it's 2,000 different locations every 3 months to get a snapshot of what the system is doing. We just can't do that in Australia, so we need partnerships in different ways to bring it along. Now, one thing we do have to our advantage is the desert in the middle of Australia, which means no one lives there. 2% of our population lives in that light yellow area. But the people who live on the edge, though, most of them have one of these. So if we went back to 1995, this is more powerful than all of the computing on the planet at that time. My watch, which is not even an iWatch, it's just an old ticking watch, it's more powerful than all the computing we had on the planet in 1970. So we have the power in our pocket. My husband is a professional graphics artist. He no longer takes his SLR anywhere with him. He just uses his phone. The image quality you can get on the phones is enormous now. So that is a huge capacity to collect information just sitting there to partner with. And you can also see that with industry as well. If we layer up where the shipping routes are, where the seismic surveys are, the fishing footprint, where the oil rigs are, where the Navy operates, the IMOS stations, the ships of opportunity collecting plankton surveys, you can see that we cover a very large proportion of our ocean estate already. We just need to partner to bring that information together. Now, one of the barriers to doing that is jurisdictions. We have those silos in departments as much as we've had them in academics, in the academic and knowledge world. My best description of how you cope with the coastal jurisdictional issues is to think of it as a bunch of two-year-olds. If it's bright and shiny, it belongs to them. If it's broken, it's someone else's problem. And that's pretty much how you have to think about dealing with the situation as well. They are very time poor, they're very stressed, it's not their problem that they feel that stress. You have to help partner with them to get beyond that. And the key part of that is we learnt with the history of the National Oceans Office is not to say that integrated management has to be everything and everywhere, but to look at the interactions. So you're making the most of where the overlaps are both a problem, but where you can benefit by working together to actually address them. And this is critical because we actually cover 14 orders of magnitude in time and space when you're dealing with the processes that influence anywhere, even the size of, say, the Ningaloo Reef. So you've got individual bacterial scale of how the reef and the photosynthesis works, up to the managers trying to do a single beach, up to the whole coastline. There's no one person that can be expert on all of those things, no matter how much they try. You need a partnership to bring both the information together, but just the understanding that it fundamentally needs. So going through my last 10 years of project work, and in particular the team I work with quite closely, I created a bit of a picture of all the different disciplines and the type of people that I work with. There's 75 different kinds of knowledge types and backgrounds involved in that, and I would say that they all are actually equally important. So right from psychologists and medical professionals through to engineers, sociologists, all that kind of thing. They do need to work together to get that big understanding. And you can see that in the frameworks that have been developed that most effectively get integrated management of the coastal zone and support the blue economy, is that while there are quite a few steps, actually people and interactions are really important to all of those steps for successful uptake. And that's because that's how you get to solutions-oriented outcomes. So scientists for a long time had a pretty bad, we probably still do, have a pretty bad rep in the political space because we're the problem identifiers. I actually had a politician say, I'd really like to actually talk to you, but you only ever come with a problem. Where's the solution? So that's with working with people. You can actually get the information, but also the direction on to make things successful. A great example of this is from Alistair Hobday's work with albatross in Southeast Australia. So he went through all of the different 25 options on how they could try and help the declining albatross population down there. I'd say the same is probably true for turtles on Ningaloo, actually. So they went through and they rated all the different options in terms of the scientific evidence it would actually work, the cost, any political or other barriers to implementation, and then the social acceptance. What they found was that the one that had the most scientific evidence, which was the cull feral animals that were coming on and killing the chicks on land, actually had the lowest social acceptance. Whereas the one that had the highest social acceptance, which was to actually introduce rabbits so they'd eat the vegetation and there'd be less fire risk, had very little scientific evidence that it would work, but it was very popular socially. So by understanding that mix, you can try and find a happy medium where there is evidence from science that it would actually work, but there's actually a lack of barriers to implementation. And it's about making it relevant. So as a mathematician, I think the guy who created the London Underground map did a terrific job of simplifying a very complex problem. My husband can't find a thing on it. He finds the London bus map much more informative because it actually tells him where things are. He doesn't have to try and guess off the name of the station. So it's about making it relevant so that the people can use the information and update the information. It is a process that has its pitfalls. It's not a magic solution. It is a time resource intensive exercise and something that was underestimated. So Fabio had the joyous task of tracking how much time I spent doing various tasks in the Ningaloo cluster project. I think we worked out it was 45 or 48% of my time was actually in that transaction of creating the partnership, supporting the partnership, communicating well. And that's not a level of transaction that I think most scientists acknowledge, but it's also an overhead on the people you're trying to interact with that already have a busy life. So you have to make it a true two-way partnership for it to exceed. And then when it does work, it works very well, as AFMA has found with its participatory fisheries management. But when it goes wrong, it can go horrifically wrong. So the top picture is the backlash to the super trawler debate that happened in Australia. There was very good scientific evidence that that was a very sustainable, low footprint way of collecting high valuable fish, but that just was not socially acceptable, so it didn't go anywhere. On the flip side, I work in Chile, and this is a picture of what happens when Chileans get upset with what's happening. They burnt the port down, they stopped all aquaculture in the area for a period of up to 3 months. And that was because of a miscommunication. They thought, the local population thought they knew what had happened when it was actually nowhere near what was the actual case. An environmental effect, an ENSO effect from climate change, had created an algal bloom that they blamed on aquaculture. So if there'd been a closer partnership, a closer connection and building of trust between the different groups, I think we could have got through that situation much more effectively than how it had played out on the ground. So I think there is a big argument for making partnerships real. So not just about having a little bit of token interaction, either at the start or the end, and putting the cherry on the top and saying, yes, we did it. It's actually about truly integrating, about building not just layers, but intermixing those layers so that there's no clear differentiation of where one bit stops and the other begins. So the world, the marine use of the world, is expanding very, very quickly. There are some huge challenges around delivering that, but partnerships such as the one that's underlying the Outlook approach is very key to both gaining understanding but delivering useful, practical outcomes on that side. When they work, they are incredibly successful, incredibly useful, but they are not a simple process to do. You do have to start from disciplinary strength, but you have to have an open mind. You have to listen to other approaches that sometimes fundamentally don't seem to make sense. So as a mathematician and ecologist, I was very much of, okay, there's an answer here. There's one mathematical equation I can use. What's all this crap about I have to go on a journey even if we don't get to a solution, which is what a lot of social scientists say. And it was actually Ningaloo that taught me that going on that journey is about bringing everyone else with you. So there's an ancient African saying that basically equates in English to, if you want to go fast, go by yourself. If you want to make sure you get there, you go slower but with a team. And that's what this partnership approach is actually all about. So, but you have to be patient, you have to be tolerant, you do have to open your mind to aspects you hadn't heard before, because there is another saying that's in pretty much every language I've been able to interact with, and I've now worked in about 90 countries around the world. They pretty much all say that you have to walk in another man's shoes before you can judge him. And that's about those other knowledges, those other stresses and drivers that you can't appreciate till you're in that situation. We can't all walk in each other's shoes all the time. So again, that's a place where collaboration helps. The inspiration and advances come from where those meet. So if you do an analysis of the major innovations in the history of the planet, the major patents, yes, multidisciplinary collaborations actually have a higher failure rate, but the breakthroughs that they make are so far beyond what an individual can do that the payoff is orders of magnitude higher. So there's a higher maintenance rate to get it to work, but when it does, it's a huge success. And that's why we need to keep these kind of collaborations going forward to support the blue economy and avoid the kind of mistakes we've made on land that led to some of the degradations that we're having to now try and undo after the fact.
Thanks, Beth. I think you'll agree that was an inspiring presentation. Beth, I think we've got a few minutes for questions if you're happy to take a few. I've got one for you, Beth.
You're talking about collaboration here. Okay. How have you found collaboration in other parts of the world?
So I would say that I would also hold the Ningaloo and what I've experienced on Ningaloo up as a pinnacle. So there's certainly a higher level of aptitude or appetite for collaboration in Australia, and particularly I've experienced up on Ningaloo. In other places, I'll give you an example from in Chile. In Chile, there's one government body that's actually funding two different groups to do exactly the same job because they don't trust either ones to deliver. When if they actually spent the money and work together, they get a much better product. In oceanography in Chile, they spend 15 times what we do in Australia, but no one talks to anyone else. So they're about 10, 15 years behind in the operational delivery of oceanography. So I think we are world standard on that. We can't rest on our laurels, but I think we have to get inventive in how we further those collaborations to now address the fact we've got such a huge coastline to cover.
So obviously when commencing this type of project, you know, there's just a vast space you could occupy. And so what kind of guiding principles did you use to sort of almost figure, explore, but maintain some limits on how far you would go with this.
So I don't know how many of you were actually in the cluster project. There's a little bit of turnover there. I went up and I sat with people and a good collaborator of mine, Jeff Dambacher. We drew what's called a sign diagram, literally a ball and stick diagram. We went to lots of different people up there and said, okay, what's central to making your life function? That was one question. So you had the social network and the information network. Then you had, how does the world work? So drew connections from the reef to the planning and all that kind of stuff. And then we brought those two kinds of networks together. And then at the first cluster meeting we had up there, we played the Where's Wally game. Can you find yourself in this huge picture of the way that Ningaloo works? And so once we'd made sure we covered everything, then we talked with the people who wanted to be up there about the way forward. Now, the output of that, the models are still there. They still are occasionally used in planning. And I think a lot of the groundwork information, such as Russ collected and Matt and others, has actually gone on to informing further work. But I would say the place we fell down a little bit on that earlier cluster work was we hadn't allowed for the political turnover. So halfway through the process, the people we thought we would deliver to didn't even exist anymore. So there's a bigger planning cycle that makes it more complicated. But just understanding the gross dimensions and talking to people about what are the unexpected parts and what are the key parts that they're interested in can help kind of shape an amoeba of the bits that people care about the most that you've got a place to start with.
Beth, you've obviously been working on the Ningaloo, and could you make perhaps a comment on what you've seen in terms of the management of the Great Barrier Reef, in terms of how you've sort of approached the Ningaloo Reef?
So there's certainly a difference between the two in that there's a legislative, there's a GBR management, they have a clear demarcation. There's less immediately on land, like the water flow problems to Ningaloo. It's more a direct pressure. So there's lessons to be learnt from the Great Barrier Reef about institutional governance and who's got the legitimacy to act and what you might want to avoid doing as much as anything. Ironically, in a way, despite the fact that GBR gets way more attention in the world, Ningaloo, I would say, is further ahead on having those planning tools in place, having the partnerships in place. So I think it's about time that the GBR started learning actually from Ningaloo, and I certainly take a lot of lessons I learned from Ningaloo back the other way.